Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since our foundation in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Last week here at Glucksman Ireland House, we had our first MA open house of the fall season. We had a lovely turnout of prospective students, of faculty members, of current students, and some of our alumni. It was a lovely event to get going. And for any of you interested in finding out more about our Master of Arts in Irish and Irish American Studies here at Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, we will have another open house on Friday, December 12th, from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. If you have any interest in finding out more about our program, just email us at ireland.house@nyu.edu. We also had a lovely Blarney Star concert. Don Mead coordinated a great concert with the well-known and really accomplished Damien Connolly, and there was a fairly full house here. We were absolutely delighted to see so many familiar faces and some new ones to us here at One Washington Mews. On this week's program, I want to talk a little bit about the Tom Quinlan Lecture, which will take place next Thursday, that is November 6th. And I'm going to talk to my colleague, Professor John Waters, in a few moments about the Tom Quinlan Lecture and about Poetry Fest 2014, and also about Belfast Noir, the crime fiction event that we're holding here at Glucksman Ireland House on Friday, November 7th. I'm also looking forward to having a chat to one Joe Quinlan. Joe is an alum of our Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies. He's actually a member of our advisory board here at Glucksman Ireland House. And most importantly, he is the son of Tom Quinlan. And we're going to find out a little bit more about Tom and about the Tom Quinlan annual lecture when we have a sit down here with Joe later on in the program. I also want to draw your attention to an exhibit that's currently running at Town Residential at 446 West 14th Street. The exhibit in question is called Tests of Time. This exhibit is based on the iconic photography of Brian Hamill. Many of you know the Hamill name pretty well. Brian has brothers, well-known brothers, such as Pete Hamill and Dennis Hamill. And Brian, similarly, is very accomplished in his field of photography. This exhibit is running until April 13th, 2015. And later on in the program, I'm going to have a chat with Wendy Maitland. During the week, I went up to look at the exhibit and have a chat with Wendy, who is one of the people coordinating bringing Brian's photography to town. And she talked about the origins of his collaboration with them there at town and about this beautiful collection of iconic photography that stretches back for a half a century at this point in time. So we'll hear from Wendy a little bit later in the program as well. I'm here sitting with someone who I call a friend and colleague, Professor John Waters, who is director of the graduate program, the Masters of Arts in Irish and Irish American Studies, and a faculty member here with strong affiliations in the English department here at NYU as well. And I thought it would be a nice opportunity to chat to John about our events coming up next week. We've a pretty busy week here in Glucksman Ireland House, the nights of November 6th and November 7th. And John, as someone interested in all things literary, is very well placed to have a chat to us. Welcome, John, and thanks for taking time. I know you're extremely busy this time of year with the various demands on your time. Thanks for coming in to us here at Glucksman Ireland House, NYU Radio Hour.
Delighted to be here, Miriam. Delighted.
So, John, we are delighted to collaborate with the Irish Arts Centre for Poetry Fest 2014, and I think we're getting the first stab at it in terms of celebrating all things poetry with the Tom Quinlan Lecture in Poetry. Can you tell me a little bit about what's going on with that?
Well, the Tom Quinlan Lecture in Poetry invites the winner of the Seamus Heaney Prize for Poetry, which is administered by the Seamus Heaney Centre at Queen's University in Belfast, to come to New York to deliver the Tom Quinlan Lecture in the form of a poetry reading or a reflection on poetry to honour Seamus Heaney and to honour Tom Quinlan. I understand you'll be speaking with Joe Quinlan, our wonderful graduate of our MA program and the person who endowed the Quinlan Family Lecture, which supports the Seamus Heaney Prize. The collaboration between Queen's University Belfast and New York University around the Seamus Heaney Prize is a real mark of distinction for us at Ireland House. I'm really pleased that it came to be because Joe has family from the north of Ireland, from Fermanagh, and he'd been traveling back to Ireland quite a bit, but also his father, Tom, was a great lover of Seamus Heaney's poetry. And the government in England saw fit to zero out the budget for the Seamus Heaney Prize just after it had gotten its legs and gotten established. So after conversations with the director of the Seamus Heaney Center, the poet of Belfast, Kieran Carson, we decided that we wanted to help keep that prize going, and Joe Quinlan stepped in and said that he thought that the relationship should be formalized and the Quinlan Lecture and the Heaney Prize winner should come together in a visit to New York and to honor his dad. So this is the fourth time that the winner of the Seamus Heaney Prize is coming to read at Ireland House. And we're delighted that this year's winner is Tara Bergen, who is both a poet and also a student and a professor of poetry. And she won for a remarkable collection of poems entitled This Is Yarrow, which she'll be reading from, but also discussing the life of the poet and of poetry in contemporary Britain and Ireland.
So then my understanding then, John, is that after the Tom Quinlan Lecture in Poetry, as it will be delivered by Tara, and just so listeners know, we do look forward to welcoming Tara to the programme when she is in town. So please keep an ear out for that. But that will kick off the 6th annual Poetry Fest, which is curated by Belinda McKeown and Angus Woods. And Poetry Fest is being delivered to us by the Irish Arts Centre. We're really delighted to come together. I see that Tara is slated to speak here. We will welcome Peter Fallon, who's a very well-known poet, of course, and someone who was a great friend of the late Seamus Heaney, Adam Fitzgerald, Miriam Gamble, Bona Grourke, Mathia Harvey, Rita Ann Higgins, Dave Lorden, Robert Pinsky, Gerald Stern and Kevin Young. So there's a really robust and diverse programme there of various poets who will take part in Poetry Fest.
That's really terrific. Angus and Belinda have just done a fantastic job every year in creating a bridge and a dialogue between contemporary Irish poetry and American poetry. And so with Robert Pinsky, Kevin Young, others, it's a stunning lineup. Most of those events are free at the Irish Arts Centre. And then there's a wonderful event on Friday evening, 7 p.m., where poets are reading and discussing their favorite poems. So I encourage everyone to have a look at the Irish Arts Centre website and to get involved and come to the Poetry Fest. It's a terrific event.
Absolutely, John. So just for people to be clear, the Tom Quinlan Lecture in Poetry and your opportunity to hear Tara Bergen deliver her lecture is here at Luxman Ireland on Thursday, November 6th at 7 p.m. It is presented in association with the Irish Arts Centre as part of Poetry Fest 2014. Now, the following night, it's a tough weekend, John. There's a lot going on, not only for people interested in poetry, but we have a wonderful event lined up here for Friday, November 7th at 6 p.m. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is going to be very enjoyable and very exciting. The launch of Belfast Noir will take place at 6 p.m. on Friday, November 7th. This is a collection of contemporary writing, crime fiction genre, edited by the wonderful, funny, extremely talented and impressive Stuart Neville, native of Belfast and I'd say one of the most impressive voices in a very crowded conversation about crime fiction in Ireland in recent years. Stuart has been a standout guest at the two previous events with which Glucksman Ireland House has been associated and supportive around the subject of Irish crime fiction, which has become very important for me as a scholar and as a student of contemporary literature, but also, I think, an important index of the relationship of literature to contemporary Irish life. Ireland has seen a remarkable explosion of talent and achievement in the crime fiction genre. All of it introduced to me via the inimitable Joe Long, former MA student in our program, whose close friend is the impresario of Irish crime fiction, John Connolly, author of the Charlie Parker novels and a very fine mind and literary scholar as well. And John's launched many a career in Irish crime fiction and been very supportive. He was the impetus behind the first event that we organized in September 2011, a symposium on Irish crime fiction, which included a number of Irish-American writers as well. And that was followed up with an event largely organized by my friend and colleague at Trinity College Dublin, Brian Cliff. Brian did a fantastic job in pulling together a festival of Irish crime fiction with 18 different crime fiction writers in Trinity College Dublin in November 2013. Material from that is available, actually, on the web and on YouTube, especially a wonderful interview that John Connolly did with the prolific and stunning Irish-American crime fiction writer Michael Connolly, author of the Harry Bosch series, of The Lincoln Lawyer, of a whole stunning array of over 20 novels. This event on November 7th is a bit of a follow-up to that November event, but it's centered around the launch of Belfast Noir, which is one in a series of very clever and very interesting books put out by a terrific press based in Brooklyn, Akashic Books. And we're absolutely delighted to partner with them and also to receive support from the Brooklyn Brewery for that event on next Friday evening, November 7th.
And John,
we have a special guest. Yeah. So
I thought you were forgetting.
No, I wasn't forgetting. No, I was saving up for that, Miriam. One of the contributors who wrote a foreword to the event is an Irish-American crime fiction writer, probably 100 million bookseller, and that's the extraordinary Lee Child, author of the Jack Reacher novels. Many listeners, I hope, will be familiar with Jack Reacher and Lee Child's use of an NYPD detective in creating one of the great franchises and series of books in the crime fiction genre. So we're going to be celebrating Belfast Noir, but also talking about crime fiction, what kinds of issues it can bring in to view, what the pleasures and perils of the form are, and we look forward to a really interesting and fun conversation. I should also say this event is a bit of a placeholder. We're contemplating a larger collaboration around the theme of Irish and Irish-American crime fiction. So if you're a crime fiction fan, watch this space and we'll see what comes up next.
So that's Friday, November 7th at 6 p.m. It is actually on a little bit early in the evening, and there are Poetry Fest events on later. So if you're really enthusiastic, you'd be able to start off your Friday here with us at the Belfast Noir event with Stuart Neville and Lee Child and some other surprise guests, as John mentioned, at 6 p.m. and then pick up on Poetry Fest later in the evening if you so wish. John, thanks for coming in to talk to us about this. It's a really busy week for us, and we're really looking forward to welcoming these diverse people to One Washington Muse. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule.
Thanks, Marion.
I'm here sitting with a very good and old friend of Luxman Ireland House, Mr. Joe Quinlan, somebody who passed through our Masters of Arts in Irish and Irish American Studies, a board member, a member of the advisory board of Luxman Ireland House, NYU, and just a long-standing supporter and friend of what we do here at One Washington Muse. Joe, your first time on the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. Welcome, and thank you for taking the time out to have a chat to us.
It's great to be back here, as always, and I did pass through the program, but very, very slowly. It's basically a one-year program, and I took the full 5 years to do it.
Well, sometimes they're our best students, Joe, so I think...
Sometimes, yeah.
So what I wanted to chat to you about today, Joe, was the fact that we have a very special event now, thankfully an annual event here at Luxman Ireland House, the Tom Quinlan Lecture in Poetry, which I've spoken to my colleague, Professor John Waters, a little bit earlier, and he explained some of the rationale behind this lecture and how it came about vaguely. But it honours a very special man named Tom Quinlan, who is your dad. Will you tell me a little bit about your father and this lecture and how it came about?
Sure. My father has been, actually, Mary Lou and I moved downtown in 1994, actually, just as Ireland House was opening. And we started attending events. And my father, who lives in suburban Philadelphia, would plan his visits up here in part to attend some of the lectures and speeches, particularly the ones involving literature and especially those involving poetry. And somewhere in that mix, he attended a weekend event here about the Yates Summer School in Sligo. And we had been sending him off to various places in Europe for week-long jaunts in the summer. And we went to Bologna, University of Bologna. But we tried out the Yates Summer School, and it worked out very well. And he wound up going, I believe, 8 or 9 times, where he met and heard and spent time with Seamus Heaney and many of Michael Longley, Helen Vendler, and many of the people that would go to this very, very special event up in Northwest Ireland that happens basically in the first 2 weeks of August every year. Anyway, we were looking for, as I was going through the program here, I noticed that there were some named lectures. They were mostly in history, though, and it seemed to be a bit of a gap or an opportunity to do something in literature, particularly in poetry. I was speaking to John one day about this and was willing to make the commitment to fund it. And lo and behold, he got a letter from the folks at Queen's in Belfast looking for some partnership possibilities because they had started a prize in honor of Seamus, with Seamus's blessing, for the best new first book of poetry. Very important to Seamus that those were the terms. And there were some budgetary issues involving the Tory government that I don't quite understand, but they had some budget challenges, and they wanted to know if there were some ways that we could somehow combine with them. So we had never gotten to the point of figuring out any criteria for the Tom Quinlan lecture other than that it was going to be about poetry. So this seemed like a perfect opportunity to work with them, and it's worked out splendidly. One of the things we found during my father's trips to Sligo, we tracked down some family legends and ran it through some genealogists, and it turns out that his roots actually are in the north. His great-grandmother, Cecilia Cox, was born outside of Enniskillen in Fermanagh, and he was able to en route to Sligo at least 4 or 5 times, visit and find some second and third cousins, and see the house on the farm where his grandmother was born. Her grandmother had died the year my father was born, in 1925, so we never knew her. But it's sort of all tied together to have some connection with the north, with Queens, where some of our relatives had, in fact, gone to school. And he was quite pleased that we were able to put this together. He now lives in a retirement community down in Philadelphia, or outside Philadelphia, and it's a very big trip for him to come up. And, you know, first we had the announcement where Seamus was here, and we had a grand time, and we've now had, this will be the third lecture, and he's prepping for it because he gets to pick the poem to open the event.
So tell me, for the benefit of our listeners, your father, of course, professionally, I mean, right, literature and poetry.
Right, he's 89 years old. He'll be 90 in January. He's always been deeply interested in poetry, going back to his grade school days, actually. There's a Catholic nun, the Sisters of St. Joseph, that really turned him on to poetry, guys, when he was in fifth grade. He told this story, and a wonderful story, that the Philadelphia Inquirer, which is the big paper in Philadelphia, did a wonderful story about my father and Seamus and all about a year or so ago, and he sort of retold all the story. But he's been interested in it since as a child. He was in the Army, Air Force in World War II. He came out, he went to college in 3 years, and then he started teaching in the Philadelphia public schools. He taught there for 43 years. And I think the number, since he is still teaching, I think it's 66 consecutive years of teaching. He taught in a variety of college settings after he retired, and he still teaches, I think, 5 or 6 times a year. He teaches 2-hour sessions at a local college in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. He has these, I'd say, literary groupies that have been following him the last 5 or 6 years who are in his age bracket. But I've been to these classes, and he is still a remarkable teacher. He's someone that he speaks, I think he was born, I think, the week or the month that the New Yorker started being publishing, and the joke is that he probably started reading it shortly after birth, because he is the most religious reader of the New Yorker that one can imagine, particularly the poetry. He's not a writer. Many people are interested in poetry, you know, write poetry. He has never written poetry, but he's extremely well-versed. I used to say that in some families you grew up rooting for famous athletes or for famous politicians. In our family, it was Wordsworth and Gerard Manley Hopkins, who were the stars.
So it was around you growing up in the household in terms of his love of poetry and literature.
Right.
Yeah.
The New Yorker was there all the time, and I never caught the bug for poetry. I was actually a literature major in college, and I was interested in theater, and I was interested in fiction. But poetry has never been something that captured my imagination in anywhere near that of my father. My father also had an interest in, he was a drama coach at his high school too. But his main claim to fame, by the way, he taught in this very, let's say, blue-collar neighborhood in Philadelphia. And his main claim to fame was that he was one of the teachers who helped to flunk Sylvester Stallone out of Abraham Lincoln High School quite a few years ago. And one of the nice things about it, one of the reasons I've always admired Stallone, is that when he won his Oscar and then came back to shoot Rocky II and Rocky III, he included many of the details and many of the people, including my father, in Rocky II and in Rocky III. Mm-hmm. So there's a cameo of my Rocky, a full screenshot of my father with his hands on his hips. And I think anybody that puts a teacher in a shot of a big movie teacher that helped to flunk you out of school, I think that shows a real sense of humor. And Stallone's a real stand-up guy as far as we're concerned.
That's a great story.
We also have pictures on the scene of Rocky. My mother was standing with Mr. T, and between Mr. T and Burgess Meredith, too, which is a nice memory from back in the early 80s.
And I now know why your dog is called Rocky.
Yes.
Right, very good. Now, one of the great things as well about this year, because I know you're a great supporter as well of another very important organisation here in New York, the Irish Arts Centre, and it's been wonderful this year that the Tom Quinlan Lecture in Poetry has been more formally incorporated into Poetry Fest 2014. I suppose it really is starting off on Thursday with the Tom Quinlan Lecture and feeding into Poetry Fest 2014. That's something that's pleased you in terms of us collaborating, you know, making sure that things Irish and poetry related are brought to the attention of people in a collaborative way.
Great. It's a wonderful thing. And we're also supporters of some of the other cultural institutions in town, the Irish Arts Center for sure, the Irish Rep. And they run this wonderful, wonderful poetry festival over the weekend. That's the natural way it falls on their schedule. And Ireland House's schedule, things fall on a Thursday. So it was a natural link. It took a little bit of back and forth because they actually farm theirs out, the programming out to some other folks, but once they heard about it, they thought it was perfectly mm-hmm. great, and they've embraced it. We're sort of the early appetizers to their main event, but the great cross-promotion, and one of the wonderful things is that they're making room. The previous two winners came across the Atlantic and gave the event here, and that was pretty much it. We'd always hoped to do more with it. Well, the perfect matchup is that our speaker this year will be, well, after she's finished Thursday, she gets Friday to rest, but then Friday night she'll be one of the people doing, their opening act is always you're reading your favorite Irish poem. So she'll be included in that. And the really good news is before the main event of this entire weekend with the Irish Arts Center, when very famous Robert Pinsky's going to be presenting, they're going to make a little bit of room for our person and have her, since she was a warm-up act for that, right dead center in the middle of the programming. And part of that, because obviously the Arts Center is very conscious of the connection with Queens and very conscious. I mean, the idea of having the Seamus Heaney Award winner to town and giving her a little bit of a showcase is a wonderful match. And once they had a little time to figure out how it fit, they really made it fit. So Aidan Conley and all those people there, I think it's really going to work out well, and hopefully we can help their attendance a little bit and they can mm-hmm. help ours too.
Absolutely, it's wonderful. It just makes sense to bring the two into a better sync, so I'm delighted as well, and thank you for your help, Joe, in facilitating that. Of course, the first Tom Quinlan lecture, which you referenced earlier, and Seamus was here for it, now so poignant for us because, you know, little did we know how short a time he was going to be around for. Your dad enjoyed that night being here with him.
It was tremendous, and we have to get that piece of tape, but we have that tape, and we should make sure to put it on the website of Seamus, because Seamus was not supposed to speak. I mean, he came to the event, and he hadn't been to the house in 17 years. He opened the house along with Mary Robinson, but he hadn't been back, and he was thrilled to be back. We had about an hour with him before the public event, and he had accepted the invitation to come with the explicit promise that he would not be called on to speak, but once he sort of, I think particularly when my father read the Patrick Kavanaugh poem, he sort of signaled to John with his finger, and he jumped up, and he spoke for several minutes in very poignant fashion about how important this award was to him, because how important, as he said, that getting that first book of poetry is crucial for poets and for artists. And it was a very warm and friendly evening. I remember afternoon that bled into the evening, I remember the roster of NYU deans that were here. We practically had our Irish foreign minister. We had all kinds of people trooping through, and nobody wanted to leave. I mean, it was a great night for literature. It was a great night for, I mean, I could see the look on the faces as Seamus spoke. You know, Seamus is a former high school teacher, too. I mean, that's what he was doing when he wrote his first book. So he spoke about academics and literature and all. You could just see them glowing. Mm-hmm. It was a Sunday evening in the fall, people you think would want to take an early slide. In fact, you had to kick them out the door, mm-hmm. I think, finally. So it was a great time.
It was a very special evening. You helped me, Joe, during the summer when I was pulling together the tribute we did to Seamus to mark the first anniversary of his passing. We pulled the audio of that event, and I think it's a good time for us to actually hear that again, because to hear those comments again, it's really, really special. Mm-hmm. Listen, Joe, thanks for taking time out today of your schedule to come in and have a chat to us, and we look forward to seeing you Thursday night and your dad.
Please come.
Yeah, the more the merrier. As I've mentioned earlier in the program, it's on Thursday, November 6th at 7 p.m. here at Luxman Ireland House. The event is free, open to the public. We're more than happy to welcome everyone along and kick off the celebration of Poetry Fest 2014 in the process. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
One of the great pleasures I had a few years ago was to do an oral history with Tom Quinlan, after whom the Tom Quinlan Lecture is named, and I thought it would be nice to dip into the archives and take a listen to the interview for the oral history for the Glucksman Ireland House oral history collection that I undertook with Tom. Over the next few minutes, you'll hear about Tom's childhood growing up and about how he got into his love of literature, etc. Sit back and relax, folks. So today is April 28th, 2011, and I'm here in Luxman, Ireland House with Mr. Tom Quinlan. So Tom, I'm going to start off by asking you, the first question I'd like to ask you is if you could tell me exactly when and where you were born and tell me a little bit about your childhood and your connections to Ireland, I guess, through your grandparents and stuff like that. We'll take it from there.
Okay. I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the year 1925. Calvin Coolidge was president at that time, by the way. Very important element in some people's lives, I guess. My grandfather was born and raised in County Cork, and my grandmother came from Northern Ireland. She lived in Enniskillen. They came to this country at a very young age, the 19th century, teenagers, I presume, moved to Philadelphia, got married, raised a large family. One of the oldest son was a man named John Quinlan. John Quinlan was my father. He was born in 1890, and he lived until 1960. He spent most of his life before marriage in South Philadelphia, where he met his wife, Edna. Edna's one dream in life was to remove him from South Philadelphia, and they moved to Northeast Philadelphia at the time. He had a job with the railroad, I think, raised a large family, and actually my life, from him, of course, he married, and he had five children, and I was number three. But my life was much more concerned with and responded to the Catholic Church. I did not live in an Irish ghetto, but I lived in a Catholic ghetto where all the priests were Irish and all the nuns were Irish, and many, many, many of the people were Irish, but not all of them. St. Patrick was not a giant in our lives. Not because we didn't like St. Patrick, but much more important was St. Joseph, because I was taught by the St. Joseph nuns. And at that time, the pastor of a parish had a choice for a holiday. He could choose St. Joseph, or he could choose St. Patrick. And the St. Joseph nuns always chose St. Joseph for their holiday. So to a school student, a holiday is one of the important elements of existence. So St. Joseph became a giant, and St. Patrick became somewhat less. My grandmother died the year I was born, 1925. So I obviously didn't know much about her. Her husband, Bartholomew Quinlan, lived in South Philadelphia as his family wandered the city. He lived there with his dog. A lengthy distance from us, so we did not communicate too often. You know, in those days when you were young, when you were 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 years old, you lived in a ghetto without really knowing it, because you had to walk every place. We didn't have a car. Nobody had a car. You went to a movie, you walked. You went to school, you walked. So it was a circumscribed existence without realizing that your whole life was, whether it was entertainment or education or troubles of any kind, friendships, they came in a very small area of a section of Philadelphia. I lived in Northeast Philadelphia, which was pretty much on the outskirts of the city. It was a time when, of course, the Archbishop of Philadelphia, his name was Doherty, he's not obviously Irish, and he was famous for building parishes, parish after parish, as these various Catholic, large Catholic families, that they grew up and got married. There were churches all over the place. And you walked to church. I never got a ride. I can't remember ever riding to church. The parish was the focus of your life. You went, first you went to Catholic school 5 days a week. And it's nuns at that time. There was an excess of nuns. There were all kinds of nuns. There were music nuns, and there were art nuns, and there were, and they knew you and you knew them, and they got to school in those days, especially at the Catholic schools. They came from very, very stable families. There was no such thing as divorce or running away or drugs or things like that. And these nuns had a very high place in the structure of the community. So you went to school for 5 days, and you had these nuns with you constantly. I remember, they had great influence. You know, when I think, you know, I've been teaching school. Seems unbelievable. I've been teaching for 63 years. But they, if I were to list the great teachers, I would have, there's a couple of nuns there that I remember. Like it was yesterday. And they were always, not always, but they were interested in your welfare. I remember when one particular nun, and I taught her for 2 years, I had this nun.
What was her name, Tom?
Sister Marie St. Joseph. You know, she, I'll tell you a little story. We used to read. She didn't have a lot of books. She had a reader, but didn't have a lot of books. You would read on Friday afternoons. She had books, something like Huckleberry Finn or something, but they were Catholic books. They were written by a priest. I think his name was Father Faber. And there were people, and she would read like a chapter or two, and on a Friday afternoon. And every once in a while, for some reason, she would leave the room and she turned to me and she says, "Will you continue reading?" Man, I was in heaven. Oh, boy, listen. Not only do you listen to her, I got time read. Oh, God. I never, and then she would come back. And I never thought, you know, this, I thought maybe she's saying a prayer somewhere. So, years later, I don't know how I found out, she was going to the bathroom. I didn't know nuns went to the bathroom. You know, they were, do saints and angels go to the bathroom, but. And every once in a while, she would take, in fourth grade, she would take me aside and take some other kids too aside. And she said, "We want to talk seriously with you, Thomas. Have you considered your state in life? You know, you're 8 years old, you know, and you really hadn't thought about it." But she said, and you mumble something, but of course, the right answer was you thought of the priesthood. And that was it. You thought of the priesthood, but she was never satisfied with that. Nuns would be happy if you said that. She said, "Yeah, what order? Yeah. Which priest?" And the key was, I didn't know until years later. She had a brother who was a Jesuit, and I mentioned that I thought about being a Jesuit. They were two of the best years of my life. But not only did you have them 5 days a week. But on Saturday, if your mother decided that you had been lived as a civilized human being for a week, and she had a dime, she would give you a dime for the movies. But always when you went to the movies, coming home from the movies, you stopped and you went to confession. You know, what could you confess? You know, I haven't done anything. You had to make up something. You know, maybe spit on somebody on the way back or something. You had to do something.
And why would you go to confession on the way home from the movies, Tom?
Because you were going to go to Mass the next morning.
Oh.
And the same nun that had you for 5 days met you there. You sat with your class, with your group, in the same order, whatever order she decided on. And if you slouched, you would feel something in the back of your neck. Or if you didn't have your fingers up. And the last thing she told you on Friday when you were walking out the door was, don't forget to go to confession. You know? It wasn't exactly in order. It wasn't out of fear. I didn't see people getting beat. You know, there's a lot of jokes now about nuns beating, little nuns beating up big kids and things like that. I didn't see much of that. It wasn't any great. There was some healthy respect, I'll say that, but it was a good life. It really was a good life, and I had a happy life.
So tell me about your mother, as in who was your mother, Irish American, or what was her background?
Yeah, but my mother. It was not an. If she was Irish American, she didn't talk about it, and it was at least two or three generations.
And she didn't identify. But so she did. What did she identify as being American?
American, yes. She had responsibilities with the family, and she just went on and did it. It seemed like she was a perpetual motion machine. You washed the clothes, and you cooked food, and you made the beds, and you washed the kids, and you did. And you went from one thing to another, and it's very easy to get in arguments. She rarely argued about anything, even when she disapproved of things. You could tell when she felt unhappy, and you felt bad about it, and was effective, I guess. But I mean, she never. She did not complain, and when troubles came on, the more the troubles would come, it would be the more silent she would be, and more reserved she would be. You could tell, I suppose, that she was the big influence on my life rather than my father, who I admired. He was a boxer, when he was young, and one thing he did is like to tell stories, and most of them were lies. And I knew they were lies. He talked about fights that he had or things that he did or something like that. But I enjoyed them. I enjoyed them even up. We would have arguments at it finally. I would just kid him all the time. Later on when I got older, and I'd say, you never did that. I was talking to a guy down the street, and he was there, and he saw Gene Tooney and Jack Depp. I was there. That kind of friendship. One thing, my father had a brother who was a priest, a Holy Ghost father. And
what was his name, Tom?
Joe Quinlan. In fact, same as my son. And then we called him Father Joe. And we didn't see him too often, but he was the one. And also he had a sister who was a nun. Now, every family had either a brother, a sister, or a friend. I knew somebody who had a priest in the family. And they were always on call, like if they had a baptism or a wedding or something like that. And that's when he would show up. But apparently he was a great linguist. And the Holy Ghost order of priests, who are active in Ireland, by the way, very active in Ireland. They run a school in Ireland, and eventually we had a lot of pictures of not a lot. He was very successful in his as a priest. He became the deputy provincial of the order or something like that in Rome, and he knew a number of prominent cardinals. He was a great friend of John the 23rd, when they were both stationed in Paris together. And I think when John the 23rd was a bishop, he was named the cardinal in Spain, in France. He had to take a loyalty oath, and my uncle gave him the loyalty oath. But anyway, he was educated far beyond anybody else in the family. So when he came, he got the royal treatment. Yeah, he would come in, and like it was the Archangel Michael coming in. You're supposed to keep quiet and take notes, I guess, because every once in a while, you know, as he got older and I got older, and I was in college, I remember, and he would come visit. It was brought to my attention that I wasn't properly respectful, and that I questioned some comment that he made. I forget what it was. I disagreed with him. There was a certain lack of enthusiasm, I would say, on the part of my mother and father, because he was treated with not as a god, but a very, very important person. My mother, they all had priests. She had a brother who was a priest, who I didn't know very well. His name, and he died. He died when I was very young. He got the flu. I said, you know what? It was in 1919, I think. It was a great flu epidemic. And he was in the seminary at the time. And they claimed that the seminarians, I think, a number of them volunteered to go out to dig graves or something to bury some of these people. And he did this. And they said, from that time, he seemed to get weaker and weaker or something. I remember walking in to see him, and he was just lying on the couch. And although he did serve in a couple of parishes, but he disappeared, or he died when I was less than 15, I think. When someone dies, he disappears in your mind. My father's sister, who was a nun, she entered the convent when she was 16, and she knew no other life, and she lived to be 84, and she was a good number. She worked very hard. She went to South America. She had a lot of interesting experiences. She also told fortunes too. Now, you don't really too many nuns who tell fortunes. She was afraid she was going to go to hell for it. She said, she would say a prayer for me. She said, I don't go to hell. Then she would reach her hand away, and you give her a little glass of beer or something. She liked to drink now and then, secretly. We never admitted it, but the beer disappeared. She was nice, and I enjoyed her.
So, Tom, your father was one of how many in the Quinlan?
My father, there was five.
Okay, and your mother?
And my mother had two sisters and a brother. And the two sisters, if they're saints in heaven, it has to be those two sisters. They took care of my the priest uncle. You know, in those days, when you were a priest, they didn't have Social Security. They didn't have Medicare, none of that. But you got sick, they just said goodbye to you. You walked out the door. Then you had a married man. You have a family. Maybe your kids will take. Somebody will take care of it. But a priest in those days, it was tough, and especially someone who was whatever disease he had, it was really debilitating. He needed like nursing, and those two women nursed him for. He lived at least more than 10 years in that condition, and they never got married. They were a big help to the family during the Depression because they both worked for Storbish and Clothiers, a big department store in Philadelphia. They never made any money, but they had a steady job, you know, for years, the two of them. And they were very good to our family. There would have been no Christmas, I don't think, without those two. They or birthdays or things like that. They were very sensitive, loving, good woman. They never got married, though. In Ireland, came through, I think, through the literature, you know, through Yeats, mostly. You know, I was teaching. I taught English, and I got interested in a lot of poetry. We were reading, you read all the great poets, and you start teaching them, and you began reading Yeats, once in a while, you think you had to, it was necessary to give a little bit of a background. And I wasn't Yeats. You know, the way Yeats was always handled in this country, he was handled as a British. You know, there's no such thing as Irish literature in the American public schools. There's American literature and there's British literature, and Yeats is always is a major element in British literature, and I taught him for many years. Because there was also another theory. The new poetic critics in the 50s said that mostly what the one of the elements of their of the studies at that time by some of the great critics is the essential element that should be taught is the poem and not the poet. It is the language and it is the message and it is all this kind of thing that's in the poem, and the poet is less significant. So I would read the poems and we'd come to Yeats and we would read them. So when I went to graduate school, I took a course in the major poets, three major men, Manly Hopkins, Yeats, and T.S. Eliot, you know, and I read even more about it. So, and then I realized that, hey, he was Irish, and there is an Irish literature. I was unaware of that. It's not taught in the public school systems of America. There's no such thing as Irish literature. Maybe Seamus Heaney might make a poem or something. Mm-hmm.
I'm here at Town Residential at 446 West 14th Street, and I'm sitting with Wendy Maitland, President of Sayens, with Town, who is here graciously giving me some of her time to have a chat about Tests of Time, an exhibit of the iconic photography of Brian Hamill, an exhibit that's running here at Town from early October 2014 until April 13th. Of 2015. Wendy, can I start off by asking you how your relationship, Town's relationship with Brian Hamill came about, and how we're surrounded here by the really impressive array of photographs, and I sense that this is probably only a snapshot of his entire collection, but there's probably, what, 50 or 60 photographs?
70
surrounding us right now. How did this all come about?
Well, it's a very long story, but I'll give you the brief version rather than the scenic version. I've known Brian since I was 12 years old. He actually was married to my sister, Betsy, and they have a daughter, Kara, who's my goddaughter, and a granddaughter, Seychelle, who's 4 years old right now. So they are no longer married, but Brian and I, and actually our whole family, has remained very close. And Brian's one of my closest, dearest friends. And since we started Town, which is a real estate firm designed to fill the niche of being best in class in the industry and in tune with the people of New York City, I couldn't think of any better photography or art to be the first pieces that we put up than Brian Hamill. So if you come to my small office, you'll see other shots of Woody Allen's Manhattan, Muhammad Ali, and some other of Brian's incredible works in black and white.
Yeah, and so Wendy, I think in talking about the exhibit and stuff like that, it really leads on to how Town engages in outreach in terms of you're not just, you know, simply a stereotypical or traditional type of real estate firm. You're engaging with your local community, and I guess Tests of Time and engaging with Brian's work is an example of this.
Yes, absolutely. We do a lot of community outreach, and we are really consider ourselves to be a part of the fabric of the community, and it's important to us to be connected to the history of the people of New York City and also to the people of New York City. But we have such an amazing city which is steeped in the history of immigrants. You know, it's really interesting that we're having this interview today because yesterday we had this beautiful autumn sky at the end of the day before sunset. I don't know if you saw it, but my apartment downtown looks out over the financial district, the real downtown, where the bedrock of the beginning of the history of New York City began in Manhattan anyway. And the Brooklyn Bridge, which is my favorite bridge, which I first walked over with the Hamills, actually, Brian and Dennis. So I was saying that the reason why I love to see the skyline as it is because you see so many buildings from so many eras, and you think, who are the people who came here for a chance and who actually created these great structures? And it's all about the people, and it's all about people who came to try to make their dreams come true. And the Irish Americans are such a great and significant and important group of those people, and it's why I also love Pete's writing so much and how he describes the immigration and of Irish Americans and then following all Americans from different parts of the world.
Yeah, the Hamels are such a great example, Wendy. When I look around here, you know, we're surrounded by photographs of people. Some of them no longer with us. You know, there are multiple images here of John Lennon, Muhammad Ali as a young man, Tina Turner, people who transcend, you know, just American popular culture. These are, you know, global figures in terms of recognition and how they've affected sports and the arts, et cetera, and filmmaking. And I guess from an Irish-American perspective, what's so interesting about it is to know that Pete and Brian's and Dennis's parents, the Hamels, came here in the late 1920s with very little from Belfast and are a really great example of that immigrant experience in terms of coming here. And to see, you know, not every family achieves the accomplishment, I think, of the Hamels overall, but must be incredibly rewarding and in some ways overwhelming for, say, the likes of Brian's parents to have imagined that their son would have gone around photographing and meeting some of these people who are icons of the 20th and 21st mm-hmm. century.
It's true. And they're all around him, too. I mean, he's really friends with these people, you know. If I need anything, you know, we needed an apartment downtown, and he said, oh, I'll just call Alec Baldwin. I think that he may be interested in talking to you, you know. And then 5 minutes later, Alec Baldwin calls me. So it's true, and it's because I think of their authenticity and their talent and their cherishing their God-given skills and talents that they helped to build and create, and they felt, I think, a responsibility to their parents to be the best that they could be, to carry on that family tradition and to take that opportunity and make something of it, because their parents, Lord knows, went through to hell and back, I think, to be here and raise all of the children.
Yeah, and you know, it's just, you know, from the point of view of Ducksmen in Ireland House and what we do at NYU specifically, we're so inspired by their example because of their Irishness and Irish-Americanness, mm-hmm. but it's a great immigrant story. There are people in this city who are, you know, of Puerto Rican descent, of Caribbean descent, of African descent, everything, doing what the Hamels have done mm-hmm. in the past and continue to do. Of the 70 images on display here, Wendy, what are the ones that really jump out at you in terms of seeing people's reactions to them or your own thoughts on them? Are there any of them that really you love?
So many of them. I mean, I can't pick out one that I don't love. There's one that Brian took. I'll tell you a couple. There's one that Brian took of Mike Tyson with his first Rolls Royce in Catskill, New York. So you see Mike standing next to the Rolls Royce in this downtrodden neighborhood in Catskill, New York. And I think that really speaks to what we're talking about. You know, Mike, who grew up in Brooklyn and maybe not as an immigrant, but really made his way and has been up and been down and has come back. And I really admire that, what's captured in that. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was such a young kid when he got what he got. And we were very close to Mike through Brian, through boxing, and also through Customato, who was one of my dad's best friends, who was his trainer. There's a phenomenal image of Warren Beatty next to Shirley MacLaine, and I love that because of the fact that they're a brother and a sister, and they each took their own journeys, and yet they each made it in their industry to become icons of the film business. We have images of people like Barry Levinson, who brought a real insight and enlightening to, for example, the culture of Baltimore and those young kids, also working class and making it. Woody Allen, his Woody Allen photos are just stunning.
What strikes me about some of the Woody Allen and Manhattan, the film Manhattan images is, you know, when I go back to Ireland, it's like, that's an example of a film which really defines people's conceptions of New York or what New York was like in the past or continues to be. And it's amazing to see the impact that that these films can make and how Brian has captured it so beautifully in the photography.
So true. I mean, it's a classic, iconic New York City film for sure. There's also images of the Rolling Stones. Again, for the same reason, working class guys. I think Brian has an affinity for those types of people, and what he captures in his photos is something that is rarely seen in photography of today, where people are snapping digitals all the time, but maybe not really capturing the essence of someone's soul and history. And I think because of Brian's past and where he came from, he's really looking for that depth and that truth within a person.
Yeah, it's the first time, Wendy, that I've had the opportunity to see Brian's work not on the internet, and I have to say, you know, when you see the prints in real life and you see the images and the power of them, to the point you just made in terms of, you know, how, you know, the selfies and the digital images and, you know, the massive images that we acquire and as amateur photographers, there's something so professional and deliberate about the way and artistic and that includes every image that surrounds us here. He's a really talented person.
And they're not just smiling photos. I mean, look at Gwyneth Paltrow right behind you. That's just a really interesting photo where you can see a lot of emotion in her face and her eyes, which is not just happy put on a smile.
Yeah, no, it's really impressive. Thank you, Wendy, for what you've done in terms of facilitating this exhibit being here and for talking to us about it today. Just so people know, Tests of Time, the exhibit of the iconic photography of Brian Hamill, will run here at Town at 446 West 14th Street, New York, New York, 10019. I believe it's the zip code for anyone GPSing it. And the exhibit is open Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and Saturdays and Sundays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Wendy, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, Miriam. Thank you.
We're coming to the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time on WNYE, on HD1, and on www.irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, my email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu, and our telephone number is 212-998-3950. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show, which is up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, stay with us here until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht.